I kept working, and I actually went out to Kansas to see the heir to Burroughs, and he had their Howard's quarter-inch safety sound roll tapes. And I went and got those transferred, like with money from another job. And so at least I had like 30-something hours of all the audio. And so I started to get a sense of what this world could be and had a kind of a sound experience. And I did a lot of work from the sound in the beginning. And I didn't know if I was gonna get into the bunker. I didn't know how the footage would be. It was a big mystery. You know, it could have very well been vinegar in all those cans. It could have had nothing, you know, pertinent. But it was always just about like working with whatever I could get my hands on at the time and just keep going.
The voice you just heard there was Aaron Bruckner, director of the documentary Uncle Howard, which pieces together the puzzle of a mysterious filmmaker from within his own family. It's one of the films playing at this year's 66th annual Berlin Film Festival. Also ahead.
Because there's so many films, you know, more than 400 films across so many sections in the program, and it's a really difficult decision trying to make what to go see, that you have to kind of just be open to seeing anything that, you know, you might not necessarily take a chance on.
We'll hear from more of the people behind this year's festival. Plus, a look back at some classic winners from years gone by, including Ingmar Bergman's Wild Strawberries. That's all to come on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of cinema on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House today. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here with me. Faye, welcome. We'll cross to Berlin shortly, but before we get into the nitty-gritty of this year's Berlinale, when we talk about the world's leading film festivals, I suppose Cannes is usually the name that springs to mind first. But if we look at the number of people in attendance, Berlin actually leads the way. About 500,000 people sit down for this event every year. That makes it the largest publicly attended film festival in the world. Now, essentially, I suppose you could say film festivals are sorts of trade fairs for the film industry, a bit of a conduit between your typical multiplex-friendly fair and some of the more original voices that we see in the cinema. But I guess events like this one, they sort of turn it into something more, don't they, Fernando?
Absolutely. And Ben, you know, we talk about the Oscars and everything, but especially for you know, a small budgeted film, I would say a win at a festival, or even if they're just playing at the festival, not necessarily winning, can be tremendous for the film. I can give you some examples. For example, you know, if a small film from Brazil, let's say, win at Berlin Film Festival, then it's going to improve the box office even in its own home country, because that's a sign of respect of a very, you know, well-known film festival in a way. And I think sometimes they, especially the Berlin Film Festival, they make sure that they're not going to give the prize to the, you know, to the mega-budgeted Hollywood film, even if it's good. I think Berlin, they like to open the space for a smaller film to shine in a way.
Well, Fernando, we'll discuss a couple of classic winners from the Berlin Film Festival from years gone by a little later in the show. But first, Monocle's contributor Antonia Mertzhauser is in Berlin this year covering the festival. She's there with film critic and friend of the cinema show, Tara Judah. Let's hear from them now.
Thanks, Ben. Tara, we are 9 days into the festival now. What were some of your highlights so far?
I really enjoyed the new Terence Davies movie, A Quiet Passion, which is a biopic about Emily Dickinson. It stars Cynthia Nixon as Emily Dickinson and tells the story of, really a feminist story, about how she struggled to become a writer and how alienated she was from other people. It's a beautiful film, a really entertaining film. It's very funny and lighthearted. I also really enjoyed, there's a documentary called The Revolution Won't Be Televised, which is about some Senegalese rappers who are revolutionaries, and all about how they used their power in rap music and as a kind of prophetic way to get other people involved in voting, in overthrowing government, and making the situation much better for people in Senegal. A really moving film, incredibly rousing, really great music, and very, very slick. Brilliant piece of filmmaking, I thought. There's a ton of other films that I've seen that were great too. I'll just mention a film called Depth 2, which is a documentary set in Serbia and Kosovo and around the Danube, and about bodies that were found in a truck there and some of the sort of devastating activities that went on during the 90s, during the kind of the war. And I really think that this is a unique piece of filmmaking. It's got very still camera movements. It shows you the landscape. We never see any of the people being interviewed, but we get interviews with some of the people who committed the crimes and also some of the victims. Very moving stuff.
What was one of the movies you saw that really like touched you and that surprised you in a good way that you didn't expect to, maybe a movie that you didn't expect to like even?
That's always a tough one because I think, you know, there's so much expectation of the films, but if you kind of, you know, got to go in with an open mind and just sort of see where the journey of the film will take you. There's a film called In the Last Days of the City, which is about a young filmmaker searching for an apartment, searching to make a film about his life and about the position that he lives in Cairo, but also with his friends in Beirut and Baghdad. And it's one of those films that isn't quite perfect. It doesn't, you know, it's a young filmmaker still at the start of his career. But what it does show is a lot of potential and this idea that this sort of yearning and reaching for something in the contemporary climate that I think a lot of people feel. And so even though maybe the situation is different from, you know, where I live or where some people viewing this film will come from, there's something really universal in that idea of kind of searching for something and how to tell a story best.
And in general, what's your impression of this year's Berlinale compared to the years before?
Well, it's interesting. I don't think there's been as many kind of, you know, big films that people have been quite as excited about. A lot of the tone tends to be seeing some very good, very strong work, but maybe not the kind of stuff that really rocks your world. I think that really, because there's so many films, you know, more than 400 films across so many sections in the program, and it's a really difficult decision trying to make what to go see, that you have to kind of just be open to seeing anything that you know, you might not necessarily take a chance on. And so for me, I think the real position of this festival is young emerging filmmakers, new works, and really taking a chance on films that perhaps you wouldn't have the opportunity to see elsewhere, because those are the ones that we want to kind of push for and that maybe we'll see more from those filmmakers in years to come. So I see this as a really great kind of discovery ground, a great place to see new and exciting films that you don't get the opportunity to see elsewhere.
Thanks, Tara, for sharing your highlights with us. Back to Ben to Midori House.
Thanks, Tony. We'll hear more from this year's Berlin Film Festival soon. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. This week, viewers in the US can catch the 1993 classic New Zealand film The Piano from director Jane Campion. And if you're in the UK, look out for the charming 2000 film You Can Count On Me, starring Laura Linney and Mark Ruffalo. And this weekend, you can also catch the wonderful 2008 movie Doubt, featuring another powerhouse performance from Meryl Streep and, of course, from the great Philip Seymour Hoffman. For now, however, we'll turn our attention back to Berlin and our contributor there, Antonia Mertzhauser. She's been busy rubbing shoulders with some of this year's most fascinating identities in the world of film. Much of the international attention of this year's event focused on the appointment of its celebrity jury president, Meryl Streep. But as Tony discovered, there's a lot more to this festival than red carpets and press junkets.
Once a meeting place for writers and artists in the 20s, then divided by the Berlin Wall for almost 30 years, the Potsdamer Platz in the heart of Berlin is a place where the history of the 20th century is inscribed. Much of it got wiped away by the clean surface of today's vapid city development, but thanks to Berlinale, every year in February, the square turns into a cultural epicenter again, overflowing with cinephiles from all over the world who come to Berlin to see the latest film productions. But it is not only about the latest movies. The Retrospektive is dedicated to the history of film, to movies that redefined cinema, and this year more precisely, movies that redefined the German cinema in 1966. That was only 4 years after West German filmmakers proclaimed that the old cinema is dead. I sat down with Rainer Rother, head of Retrospektive, and asked him how political circumstances left their mark on the German film in year 66.
It's not 68 or something like that with the students' revolution, it's 66, because this is the year where the films in East and West went in different directions. And surely that has to do with the political situation as well. For example, the East German production company DEFA, they produced a lot of films, around 20 films that year, and more than half of them were forbidden, so they couldn't be presented in the cinema, or, as we have one example, they were shown, one film was shown, Spur der Steine, just for a few days, and then was banned as well. Why? Because these films took a close look to the reality and the problems of the GDR. So they had the idea, the authors and the directors, that since the wall already was built, they are now in a situation where they can concentrate on the society, on their society, and discuss the problems and chances of that society. But they were wrong. The party proved that that is nothing to be discussed.
At the same time in France, the Nouvelle Vague was about to change the cinema forever and also left a mark on the German film.
They were aware of the Nouvelle Vague, and maybe they were even aware of the Nouvelle Vagues in the Eastern European countries, like in Poland and Czechoslovakia or Hungary. And they wanted to do the same thing. That means not to produce the films in studio, but shoot films on location, not to tell the old melodramatic stories, but to concentrate on daily life problems. And that's what they really did, and that's why these films are so fresh.
And now I would like to make a connection to this year's Berlinale. In the press conference, you mentioned the funny coincidence that we talk about the year 66, and it's the 66 Berlinale. So how present would you say are the themes from year 66 in contemporary German cinema?
Interesting question. I think that there are directors who are really working in that kind of spirit, because they are concentrating on, let's call it simple stories, let's call it daily life stories. And like the movement in 66, they are also fascinated by the international cinema, very much influenced by, let's say, the French film again, but also the Asian cinema.
It's nice to be boss. With these words, Meryl Streep started into her 10 days jury presidency, together with Clive Owen, Alba Rohrwacher, Lars Eidinger, Małgorzata Dżumowska, Brigitte Lacombe and Nick James. She will decide whose film will receive the Golden Bear and follow the legacy of big names such as Yerfa Panahi, Ang Lee and Terrence Malick. And for someone who reviews movies for his living, this sounds like a fairly suitable job. Nick James, who is a film critique and editor for Sight and Sound, tells us why he doesn't take the job easily and what makes Berlinale stand out from the other festivals.
It's a much more serious business. I mean, it's still a very serious thing to write about a film that many people spent several years of their lives making. So it's a serious thing to begin with, but when these prizes could really change people's careers dramatically, it becomes even more serious. So the judgments you're making on the jury can be life-changing for some people. So you don't want to be undervaluing any film, or indeed overvaluing any film. So, you know, the debates that we have in juries are crucial. They're really important.
How much debate is there?
There's a lot. There's an awful lot of time being put aside. We're talking about each individual film, so that no film, you know, is in any way dismissed. It's very thorough. It's a really thorough process, agreed at the beginning, and one that everybody is engaged with.
So, do you think you see movies, you watch them differently?
Yes, because in many cases, especially with art house, foreign language, you know, mixed language cinema, perhaps some of us on the jury will know more than others about the previous work of the people we're looking at.
A romantic comedy that is candid and witty, that comes without trite dialogues, and that expresses critique about political circumstances by opening up a discourse on public space. I can't believe how much we narrow the streets we live in says Bibi after reviewing options on how and where to meet in public, with the only result that the religious police will be chasing after them wherever they go. The streets Bibi is talking about are the streets of Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, where Baraka, a civil servant with a passion for theater, and Bibi, an Instagram and video blog celebrity, try to get to know each other under the strict regime of Saudi Wahhabism. Baraka Meets Baraka, a movie by Mahmoud Sabah, is a true gem of this year's Berlinale and the only Saudi Arabian contribution. Hisham Faghi, the charismatic young actor, producer and writer, who is part of a young and creative scene of filmmakers who have already been labeled as the new independent Saudi cinema, tells us how to shoot a movie in a country where cinemas are still on the blacklist.
The main difficulty was the fact that there are no real actors or industry for filmmakers. So what ended up happening was we were very keen on just training and practicing as much as possible. The first question is, there's no films, but there are content creators making stuff for web and TV and, of course, theater actors, etc. So you have an ecosystem of creativity, even though it's small, but it's existence. So you try to do what you can with whatever resources. And this is part of being a creative, is you make do with what you have.
So what's the situation like at the moment for you as a creative, as a producer, as a person that wants to, you know, realize their own projects, work with other artists? Do you think that there is a turning point at the moment, also considering that there is, of course, so much access to foreign media?
I think we have to, like, not be so ambitious. I can't make a movie like Transformers or Fast and the Furious because the industry is non-existent when it comes to that type of film. But when you see a humble, quirky films like Baraka Yuqabil Baraka, it makes you think like, okay, that's doable. I can do that. I can even do stuff with animation because they're really good animators in my country. There are initiatives, but like I said, there's no institutionalized entities. So it's all private and it's all just initiatives that are starting on a personal level or on a private level. What I need is I need people to appreciate it, because with appreciation and affection towards film, people will then want to work in film, and then people will respect that sort of craft. It's an emotional ecosystem. So hopefully if this film does well and Saudis can watch it and say, oh, this represents me and this is not offensive and this isn't pandering to the West, then this is a huge building block that we're setting.
Antonia Mertzhauser there at the Berlin Film Festival. We'll hear from director Aaron Bruckner about his documentary screening at this year's festival a little later. But up next, a look back at another classic winner, 1957's Wild Strawberries. You're listening to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 in association with MUBI. The 1957 Swedish film Wild Strawberries has long been celebrated as one of cinema's most wonderfully introspective works, and its Golden Bear win in 1957 helped cement Ingmar Bergman as one of the most influential auteurs. Wild Strawberries tells the story of Dr. Isaac Borg, an aging professor who has all but removed himself from any kind of social contact, his cold demeanor keeping even his own family at distance. As he takes a long drive home to Stockholm to accept an honorary degree, various stops along the way take him on a somewhat unexpected emotional journey. Paul Duncan is one of the editors of the Ingmar Bergman Archives, a thoroughly beautiful and absolutely enormous volume chronicling the many immortal achievements of this seminal filmmaker. He guides us through his take on the auteur classic.
The thing about Bergman was that he started off as a writer, so a lot of his early films are very theatrical, and it wasn't really until Seventh Seal, the film he made just before Wild Strawberries, that he really came into his own as a director and writer and broke the mold internationally, if you like. I think the key element of Wild Strawberries is that it's a film about a man reflecting upon his own life. So it's something that people in all countries could identify with. So you have Isaac Borg, IB, perhaps Ingmar Bergman himself as well. He was 37 years old at the time, reflecting on his life as he takes a journey from Stockholm to Lund to pick up an award. So I think that it's that identification of somebody who's in middle age or old age reflecting on their life in the movie is exactly what Bergman was doing at the time. And so I think that's a universal theme. It's a reflective film. So Bergman originally came up with the idea, if you like, because when he was visiting his old place where he used to live, and he thought that when he opened the door to where he used to live, he could actually walk back into the past. And I think that this is something that when you reach middle age, you think about what's happened in the past. You think about the regrets. You think that you have underachieved. You think that nothing you do is good enough. And this is exactly what Bergman was thinking. This is what the central character was thinking. And I think middle age is a period of doubt, of uncertainty. When you were young, you thought about the future and everything was going to be great and you were going to create something. Middle age, you think, well, what have I done? Really, it hasn't really worked out. You're still in that uncertain age. And that's what Bergman captures brilliantly in Wild Strawberries. What Bergman does brilliantly is that he creates a real nightmare, a nightmare that feels as though it's real life, and you're not quite sure what's going on. And what he's doing is he's reflecting what's going on psychologically within the character. You know, as Dali would do in a painting or even in some films with Hitchcock, for example. So that aspect of it is very interesting, but I think really for me, this idea of reflection, of following a person's face through a movie, is the important thing that Bergman brought to cinema. So you can see this in, for example, Harry Dean Stanton's face in Paris, Texas, or Richard Farnsworth's face in Straight Story, that these are characters on a journey, as in Wild Strawberries, reflecting on their lives and going to somewhere and not knowing how they're going to be received, wondering whether their lives have been worth it. So I think that Bergman started something with Wild Strawberries that other great filmmakers have continued.
Paul Duncan there, editor of the Ingmar Bergman Archives, which is available now, published by Taschen. As we've been hearing today, the Berlin Film Festival has a long history of shining a spotlight on some of the world's most original filmmaking voices, and this year is certainly no different. You may recall a documentary released back in 1983 called Burroughs, the Movie, which was an illustration of the celebrated author, among many other things, William S. Burroughs. That film was directed by Howard Bruckner, who sadly passed away in 1989 at the age of just 34. Uncle Howard is a new work from the director's nephew, Aaron Bruckner, which sets out to piece together the story behind Howard, his short but colourful career, and why his breakthrough project almost ceased to exist following his death. Antonia Merzhauser caught up with Aaron at the Berlin Film Festival.
James Grauerholz, the heir to William Burroughs, told me there was much more than the film and sent me an inventory of Howard's archive, stored in 1983 in the bunker, Burroughs' former home in New York City.
Howard? Boy, I'm so surprised it exists. Wild tracks. And when we say wild, we mean wild tracks.
Okay, well, make sure.
Howard's work was stored in the legendary bunker on Bowery for decades. Preserved by John Giorno, poet and close friends of Burroughs, it took Aaron several attempts until he gained access to the long-forgotten archive.
Well, it was so hard. And with the bunker, because also the bunker was one aspect of Howard's story. It was a wild goose chase all over the world, really, to find all these different things. But with the bunker, John had guarded that place for 30 years. And, you know, I found out in the course of my looking for other films, like the Civil Wars, that all the negative outtakes had been thrown away. And actually throwing out negatives and rushes, what you would say, it was kind of standard practice. So John being that way, having preserved that there with that attitude, was actually kind of great. And I'm kind of really grateful he did that. But, you know, in the year or so it took to convince him, or, you know, plead my case, if you will, I kept working, and I actually went out to Kansas to see the heir to Burroughs, and he had their Howard's quarter-inch safety sound roll tapes. And I went and got those transferred, like, with money from another job. And so at least I had, like, 30-something hours of all the audio. And so I started to get a sense of what this world could be, and had a kind of a sound experience. And I did a lot of work from the sound in the beginning. And I didn't know if I was going to get into the bunker. I didn't know how the footage would be. It was a big mystery. You know, it could have very well been vinegar in all those cans. It could have had nothing, you know, pertinent. But it was always just about, like, working with whatever I could get my hands on at the time and just keep going.
Once Aaron completed the first challenge to find and restore the old footage, a second challenge arose. What do you do with over 100 hours of footage?
And I never looked at anything like if it's too private or not private for the story. It's just what works for the story. I mean, I had a ton of footage. You know, I had 30-something hours just from the Burroughs outtakes, 30-something more from the Bloodhounds, you know, plus all the stuff I was shooting. And I, you know, went far and wide with my scope of covering as much of Howard's different sides and people in his life as I possibly could. And it, you know, it was just a ton of editing. I edited with a development editor for a year and a half. I sat down with, you know, the editor of the film for 20-something weeks, you know, every day from 10 o'clock in the morning to 7 o'clock at night or later. And just, you know, molding it, and you just end up finding what works for your story and what doesn't. And, you know, we knew that we wanted to, A, keep this very kind of pure childlike perspective across the film, have it have that. B, be true to Howard's story on the ground. And also not have the film end in a linear way with Howard dying. It was very tricky to not fall into that trap of just getting into what is his story, because his story is interesting, it's entertaining and tragic, and most people don't know it, so you can kind of get into that. But then to end on, you know, him dying before Bloodhounds comes out, not only does it just suck, it's depressing, but I wanted the film to be about so much more, about legacy, about what you do with your life, the AIDS epidemic, a reflection, a way to look back on New York and touch on gentrification and all these themes that wouldn't have come out of that.
Antonia Mertzhauser there in conversation with filmmaker Aaron Bruckner in Berlin. And that's just about it for this week. Now, there are, of course, just as many film festivals operating today as there are films, but only a few carry the kind of prestige to determine whether the most obscure Nepalese drama or the latest Coen Brothers heavyweight deserves to be seen by the many. The fuel of a festival, however, is really curiosity. So don't take it from me. Read up, sit down, and watch. Today's show was edited by Nina Norick and researched by Yulian Goffin. Listen again and find out more over at monocle.com. The Cinema Show returns next week. Until then, I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.